Okay, I think welcome to the eighth, I think, iteration of Cognitive Science 200, Spring 2007, The Temporal Dynamics of Learning. I'm very happy to have our first guest from outside UCSD, I believe, Michael Frank. And he's here from the University of Arizona by way of the University of Colorado, where he worked with Randy O'Reilly. And who else there?
Tim Curran,
both members of our Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center. And he's going to talk to us today about decision making and modeling, neural modeling based on an anatomically correct, as it were, model of the basal ganglia and the orbital frontal cortex. So take it away, Michael.
Okay. Great. Well, I'm happy to be here. I guess the title of my talk is Interactive Dynamics of Striatal Cortical Circuits in Reinforcement Learning and Decision Making. So because it's temporal dynamics of learning, I'm going to try to emphasize some of the dynamic aspects of the models. And mainly I'm just going to motivate it by saying that what I'm mainly talking about, the brain areas that I'm talking about, are the basal ganglia and their interactions with frontal cortex. And the basal ganglia are classically thought to be involved in motor control. So a lot of people know that patients with Parkinson's disease or other forms of damage to the basal ganglia have deficits in motor control. They have tremor, rigidity, slowness of movement. But what's less well appreciated but is increasingly studied is that these patients also have cognitive deficits. And what we're trying to address with the research is how do the same circuits that interact between basal ganglia and frontal cortex in the motor domain can also extend to the higher level cognitive domain. So in this case, the example here, this is supposed to be a patient with Parkinson's disease, and you can see at the highest level they have symptoms, which are supposed to be depicted here by these little curvy lines. But then you might want to drop down a level of analysis and look at gross anatomy. And so this is just to situate yourself, the basal ganglia, this is actually the striatum, the caudate nucleus, and the putamen. And what is damaged there, specifically in Parkinson's disease, is that they have depleted levels of the neurotransmitter dopamine in the striatum. So over here you're looking at a SPECT image, and this is a healthy participant, and this is basically a measure of how much dopamine they have in their striatum. You can see it's glowing red. They have a lot of dopamine. They're healthy, happy. And this is a patient with Parkinson's disease who has spared dopamine, in this case, in the head of the caudate, but depleted dopamine in the rest of the striatum. And so this is a particular good model for studying what are the effects of dopamine in the striatum on both motor control and on cognition. And even though in this case there's just one simple neurotransmitter that is depleted in one brain area, at least in the early case of the disease, the resulting cognitive deficits are actually seemingly unrelated and complex. So I'm going to argue that in this kind of situation that using computational models can be helpful, because as everyone who studies neuroanatomy or who has taken a neuroanatomy course knows, the basal ganglia architecture is particularly convoluted. It's famous for being convoluted. And so when you try to implement it in a computational model, you can try to explore how these areas interact dynamically and how they can be involved in decision making. Okay, so what I'm going to argue today is that I think there's at least four computational roles of the basal ganglia in decision making, or at least in basal ganglia interactions with frontal cortex. So I think of these systems as...
So does this mean it's a convolutional neural network?
I think that's a joke. So I think of basal ganglia and frontal cortex as a functional unit. So you can't really... I don't think either the frontal cortex or the basal ganglia would work by themselves. So the roles in decision making I'm going to emphasize today are, number one, action selection, choosing between different actions, which is involved in both motor control and in decision making. Number two would be reinforcement learning, which is popular these days to study, which would be which choices are most or least likely to lead to reward. Number three, I'm going to talk a little bit about dynamic modulations of decision thresholds. So what do I mean by that? Essentially, how do you know when to take more time to decide? So when you're making a decision and the decision is actually hard, you might want to actually take more time to make that decision relative to some decisions that are easy. And number four, I'll talk a little bit about working memory updating and maintenance, but not in the whole context of the more interesting working memory field, but just in the restricted case of maintaining recent stimulus action outcome values. And that the system that maintains recent outcome values of reinforcement values is actually different computationally than the system that learns based on basic reinforcement learning. And now all this might seem a little bit vague and convoluted right now, so I'm going to try to motivate it in a way to be a little bit more concrete by presenting a simple task that has all of these components. So the task is referred to as the probabilistic selection task, and I usually run these in my empirical studies, in almost all studies, along with sometimes some other tasks. But a lot of people sometimes ask me why I always run this one task, and the reason is that it involves all the components that we're trying to study. So it's also a fairly simple task. So a subject is presented with these two different stimuli. They're Japanese hiragana characters, and the subjects do not know Japanese. And we just use those characters because we're trying to prevent them from explicitly verbalizing strategies to the task. And they're just asked to choose the right or the left. So normally when we ask them to do this, they just sort of stare at you and they say, what do you mean, choose one of them? Why do I have any basis for choosing one or the other? And we just say, you know, go ahead and choose them. Or the instructions say, go ahead and choose them. And they might choose one, let's say, on the right side, and they get feedback which says correct or incorrect, or in this case, they would get a happy face. And then they're presented with another pair of stimuli. They're also another set of Japanese characters. They might choose one on the left, and then they would get negative feedback, a cross-out signal. So it turns out in this particular task, the structure of the task is probabilistic. So there are three different pairs of stimuli, which we refer to as A, B, C, D, and E, F for convenience. And they all have different probabilities of reward. So in the A-B pair, A is rewarded on 80% of the trials, and B is only rewarded on 20% of the trials, and vice versa for negative feedback. So they get feedback after each one of these trials, and I'm going to talk about in a minute how that feedback might relate to the dopamine system that interacts with the basal ganglia. The only other part of the task that you have to know about is that once they're finished learning all these pairs to a certain level of criterion performance, they're represented with a test phase. So the test phase represents these same pairs again, but also all novel combinations of the stimuli. So for instance, 80 versus 40, 20 versus 60, and so on. And they have no feedback in that test phase. So we want to know both based how well can people learn these probabilities, and then how well can they generalize them to compare different probabilistic values during some test phase later on. So it should be relatively clear how these four components map onto that task. So number one, action selection. Simple, you're just choosing amongst multiple competing actions. In this task, it's only two. Reinforcement learning, how do you know which choices are most least likely to lead to reward? So there's probabilistic values. Decision thresholds would be, how do you know when to take more time to decide? So if you're asked in the test phase to choose between a stimulus that was 80% rewarding versus 70% rewarding, or 20 versus 30, the values that 80 versus 70 and 20 versus 30 is relatively hard to discriminate compared to, let's say, 80 versus 40. And so you should actually slow down. You should raise your threshold for making a decision in that case. And finally, what do I mean by working memory, updating, and maintenance of recent stimulus outcome experiences? I mean that if you choose, let's say, C in a CD trial and you get negative feedback, how likely are you to remember the next time you see CD, which might be like three trials later, that you got negative feedback on the very last trial? And how likely are you to actually change your response on this next trial? And what I'm going to argue is that the brain systems involved in doing that fast trial-to-trial switching or accounting for positive and negative reinforcement learning systems are actually different than the ones that slowly integrate probabilities over time in point number two. So I'll come back to that. Okay, so to motivate the overall role of the basal ganglia in action selection, I'm borrowing a figure from Rich Ivory, which shows how the basal ganglia essentially can act like a dam. So you have possible responses being considered or activated in this case, we're thinking of it in premotor cortex or pre-SMA up here. And the main role of the basal ganglia is actually to shut that off, to prevent you from actually executing all of those commands at the same time. So to give a concrete example, if you're trying to reach for a glass and pick up a glass of water and drink, a simple motor sequence, your cortex is probably activating all the different possible aspects of that sequence at one time. And you need to have some way of coordinating which aspect of the sequence to facilitate at any one time. Otherwise, you'd sort of, you know, close your hand before moving it and maybe knock over the glass and make a fool of yourself. So the role of the basal ganglia in this sort of example is just to prevent you from doing everything that you're considering at one time.
but then to facilitate the most active or the most appropriate response at any one time while continuing to suppress competing responses. So that's what it says down here. The basal ganglia selectively facilitate one command while suppressing others. This has been explored both computationally and based on classic theoretical models. It's based on a lot of anatomical and physiological studies. And we and others have argued that this same essential function of action selection occurs in parallel for multiple circuits leading the basal, linking the basal ganglia with frontal cortex. So not just in the motor domain, but it also extends to higher level cognitive actions, like making decisions. So one question that immediately comes up is, how do the basal ganglia know which action is the most appropriate one to select at any one time? And what I'm going to focus on today a lot is how they learn it, essentially by carrot and by stick. So what do I mean by that? These are recordings from midbrain dopamine cells in the monkey. A lot of this work comes out of Wolfram Schultz's lab. This particular study is from Sato et al. In Japan. This is a monkey making a correct choice in a cognitive task, and it gets a reward that he did not expect. That monkey gets a sudden phasic increase in dopamine firing when he makes a correct choice. But when he makes an incorrect choice and he thinks he's going to get a reward but does not get a reward, you see this phasic dip in dopamine firing, or a pause in dopamine firing. And there's been a huge amount of work on this in the last 15 or 20 years. People have done a lot of studies in monkeys. People have also related these to formal learning theory. People have developed computational models of how these come about. I'm actually not going to focus on any of that in the talk. What I'm going to focus on is that, given that this occurs, what are its effects on learning in the striatum and frontal cortex? And I'm basically going to argue that, at least for some forms of reinforcement learning, this increase in dopamine corresponds to the carrot, and this decrease in dopamine will correspond to the stick. Any question?
Were these neurons in the ventral tegmental area?
So in this particular study, I don't know, but I know that in Wolfram Schultz's studies, who he's done a lot of these, he records both from the VTA and from the substantia nigra pars compacta, and to this date, they haven't recorded any differences. It seems like all the dopamine cells basically do this, but people are trying to examine that more carefully now, and I'm not sure that that's going to hold up.
But is the VTA considered part of the basal ganglia, or not part of
it? It just depends on who you ask and what book you look at, I think.
Can I ask a dumb question? What does phasic mean here?
Phasic just means deviation from tonic, where tonic is this kind of baseline firing. And phasic is just a punctate event that happens where it goes up or goes down.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay. So here's a cartoon of the overall functional circuitry between the basal ganglia and frontal cortex, where here, this is an example where you're choosing between two possible responses. So think of it as choosing A or B in that task I was mentioning. And those are both being activated or considered in premotor cortex. And the role of the basal ganglia is to somehow select one response and inhibit the other response. And it turns out it doesn't do that directly by interacting directly to premotor cortex. It does it via this middleman of the thalamus, where the response one and response two are represented topographically in different areas of the thalamus, and the basal ganglia has to somehow facilitate one of these responses and suppress the other. So the big question is, what's in this big circle, and how is it able to actually choose one response and suppress the other? And the answer is simple, it's just like that. So, of course, it's not quite that simple, so I think that's the motivation for why we wanted to explore it computationally. So here, I'm not expecting you to get much from looking at this diagram and understand exactly how it works from looking at this, but I am going to break it down in a minute. The only thing I'm going to say on this slide is that this is the computational model that we built to try to implement what's known about the biological circuits linking the basal ganglia with frontal cortex. And it was based on a wide range of physiological data across different species and taking into account pharmacological data and various other aspects of data. And so we're not inventing how the basal ganglia are involved or how they're connected to different areas. We're really just trying to explore how the dynamics, according to the circuit, can facilitate and suppress decisions. And I'm also not going to go into the equations. And these equations are just shown to show that the neurons in these models correspond to standard physiological equations used for modeling neurons, and they're point neurons. They're not biophysical neurons. Okay, so breaking down the functional circuitry, I'm going to start with the output of the basal ganglia, the globus pallidus internal segment. It doesn't matter if you're not familiar with the terminology for the different brain areas. But the main idea is that these neurons are tonically active, which means they're firing at a fairly high frequency in the absence of any input, and they're inhibitory onto the thalamus. So when they don't have any input, they're always inhibiting the thalamus. And this is effectively implementing the brake, so it's the dam. It's preventing the thalamus from actually exciting any area in premotor cortex. And what I might have forgot to say is that although different areas of premotor cortex can get active, they're going to be able to get more active and actually execute a command if they get bottom-up support from the thalamus. So if the GPI is tonically inhibiting the thalamus, it's preventing any one action from essentially winning the competition and getting selected. So I'm going to show a few simulations of this as I go along so you can get a sense of how this is encoded in the model. So here's a model that just has some stimulus input and is activating competing noisy representations in cortex. The GPI is tonically active and tonically inhibiting the thalamus. So that was quick. I'm going to show it again to get you situated. So these neurons are tonically active. This big yellow square means active, and they're inhibiting the thalamus. None of these actions are actually winning in cortex. So that's not very interesting because there's no selection going on, but that's just the first order pass of what's happening in this circuitry. But then the major segment, input segment of the basal ganglia is called the striatum. There's a population of cells there which we refer to as go cells, because when they get active, they inhibit the GPI. So these neurons are inhibitory. They send inhibitory GABAergic projections to the GPI, which were inhibiting the thalamus. So this leads to sort of a double negative, which is referred to as disinhibition, so that when these neurons fire, they lead to the facilitation of a particular action in cortex. So let's watch a simulation of that. So now we have a striatum here, different responses getting considered here. And you can see there's a population of units that I'll call go units that inhibit the GPI here, disinhibit the thalamus, and select a response in cortex, while the other response gets suppressed. And that is it. And so I won't have very much time to go into this, but it can be shown computationally how this disinhibitory circuit leads to a gating function. So it's actually better than if the circuit would somehow have been directly excitatory onto the thalamus. So essentially it means that when a go neuron fires, it doesn't mean that that response is actually going to get executed. It means that it's only going to get executed if the cortex also sends top-down activity to the thalamus. So it's really encoding the conjunction between a response being considered in cortex, activating the corresponding part of the thalamus, and a go unit facilitating that action at the same time. So in the striatum, there's another population of cells that are differentiated both based on biochemistry and their efferent projections that we will call no-go units. And effectively, what they do is just suppress an action. So they're supposed to suppress competing actions when you're faced with action selection problem. And the way they do that is just by going through one more inhibitory synapse, another part of the globus pallidus. But I'm not going to spend too much time on this because I want to get to the rest of the talk. But I will show you through a simulation, and you have to watch this a little bit carefully. So if you're going to actually select between two different actions and you want to avoid one action, you're going to potentially avoid that action first and then switch over to the other action and facilitate it. So in this simulation that I'm going to show you, the response 2 is going to first get activated, and you're going to see no-go for response 2 in the striatum, and then it's very quickly going to shift over to go for response 1. So here it comes. Response is being considered. Here's no-go for response 2, so it's saying don't select response 2, and then it shifts over and says, oh, go for response 1, and that gets selected in cortex. And finally, here's dopamine coming from the substantia nigra pars compacta, also from the VTA. It projects to the striatum and activates both go and no-go cells via D1 and D2 receptors. And the reason why I'm distinguishing between D1 and D2 receptors is twofold. So first of all, the go and no-go neurons preferentially express D1 and D2 receptors. So there is some colocalization. D1 and D2 receptors are expressed in both cells, but there's a large amount of segregation. So for the most part, these neurons have D1 receptors, and these neurons have D2 receptors. And also, the effects computationally of dopamine on these different receptors is different. So dopamine is inhibiting D2 receptors, which means dopamine is tonically inhibiting no-go activity, whereas dopamine is exciting synaptic activity in go neurons via D1 receptors. So dopamine has this push-pull effect on go and no-go activity in the striatum. And this overall model is just consistent with the classic model of basal ganglia function since 1989, where increases in dopamine lead to essentially more motor activity, more go and less no-go. Decreases in dopamine would lead to more no-go because there's less inhibition of these D2 receptors and more slowness of movement, as you see in Parkinson's disease. So how do these changes in dopamine during learning map on to the basal ganglia circuitry? So when you get this positive feedback after making some rewarding choice, the idea is that this phasic increase in dopamine would amplify go activity transiently for the response that was just selected via D1 receptors. And that this sudden increase in go activity leads to LTP, which is long-term plasticity, long-term potentiation, where the weights actually to these particular go neurons increase. What does that mean? It just means that when the system made a choice that was rewarding, it should learn that the next time around it's in that same situation, it should be more likely to make that choice. So it's learning go to a particular response in the context of some particular environmental stimulus. And I'll just show a simulation of that. It's going to be the same. So it gets some input, activating different responses. It gets go for response one. It's going to get inhibition here, disinhibition here, selection. And soon enough, you're going to see an increase in dopamine in this area because the model happened to make a correct choice in this particular situation. So you just keep watching that. And here's that phasic increase in dopamine, and it's reinforcing go firing. So these units are now learning go to response one in the context of that particular stimulus. And then there's the flip side of the coin where the system makes an incorrect choice, and it gets this phasic dip in dopamine. And the idea is that that actually leads to increase in no-go firing. And that's because dopamine is normally inhibiting these units. When it gets decreased, it actually releases that from inhibition, and these units get transiently activated. So the system is activating no-go units, and it's also driving learning in these neurons at that time. So the system learns when it makes a choice that's not rewarding, it should avoid making that choice again in the future. I'm just going to skip that simulation.
I have another question about the source of the dopamine. Have people shown phasic and tonic responses in the substantia nigra dopaminergic neurons?
Yes.
They have?
Yes. So here's the overall functional circuitry again. I've sort of ignored some aspects of it, like the subthalamic nucleus, which I might come back to a little bit later, and some other the other projections, but they have been included in other forms of the model. So you can see that the overall circuitry is relatively complex, and maybe more complex than this, and definitely more complex than this. But there's a huge amount of evidence over the last, 30 years or so collected for this overall model. You can apply different dopamine drugs to these different neurons and look at different activities. I'm just going to highlight one study from Yang, Stein, and Mahaffey from 2003, where they're recording from the substantia nigra, different part of the substantia nigra. This is just like the GPI. It just depends on, I'll ignore that. So they're recording from this area. And the monkey is actually making a saccade to one direction and suppressing a saccade to the other direction. And what they found is that cells that coded for the direction that the monkey actually looked towards in this area demonstrated a transient decrease in activity that's consistent with a go signal coming from the striatum and inhibiting those cells, while at the very same time, cells that coded for the opposite direction had a transient increase in activity, which is consistent with a no-go cell coming and actually increasing activity in the competing action. So you have simultaneous facilitation of one action while suppression of the other action. Okay, so there are a bunch of other movies. I'll just show one of them in a bigger model that selects between four different responses and has a lot of noise. And you can just get another sense of how the dynamics happen. And if you're interested in looking at some of these with more detailed explanations and on your own time, if you happen to be interested in this circuitry, these movies are all on my website with additional explanations. Here's just one more example of a positive feedback trial. Here's four different responses being considered. They're all noisily activated. There's noise in the striatum, but you can see that go for response two happens to be active more than the other ones. So eventually, it inhibits its corresponding GPI cell, disinhibits the thalamus, and allows the system to actually select response two and inhibit the other responses, and then it gets positive feedback for it. Realize that was a little bit fast, but
I encourage you to look at those on your own if you're actually interested in this circuitry.
So the initial model was used to try to account for different both enhancements and impairments as a result of dopamine medication in Parkinson's disease in learning tasks, learning and decision-making tasks. And it was able to capture a couple of different patterns of results, which I'm not going to go into any further here because I want to focus on some predictions that the model made. And one of the reasons for that is that a lot of people claim when you can use a neural network model to account for different patterns of results, that it's a nice account of the data, but neural networks can account for a lot of different patterns of data. So how do you know that the model is actually the correct model? Of course, we never know whether a model is correct. But one way of making progress is if you can make new predictions and then test them. And then if you're wrong, then you've learned something just as much as if you're right. So one simple thing that the model suggests was that low dopamine in Parkinson's disease should impair positive reinforcement learning, or go learning, while sparing no-go learning, because no-go learning actually depends on low levels of dopamine during negative feedback. Whereas when patients are actually taking their medications actually increase their dopamine levels, and that should improve their go learning, but at the same time, it should actually block the effects of their dopamine dips that are normally needed to learn no-go. So what I mean is that in the normal system, when you make a choice that's not rewarding, you get this dopamine dip. But if you're taking medication that's constantly stimulating dopamine receptors, it actually would prevent the system from ever having this effective dopamine dip. So your brain sometimes wants your dopamine to go low, and taking these medications doesn't allow that to happen. Is there a question?
Why isn't there a tonic-phasic distinction here? You said that this is independent of the tonic level, that this is just a phasic effect. So why should systemic administration of dopamine, which just raises or lowers the level, have this effect?
Well, so we've already done, you could show in the model also that you need to have a really low level of dopamine right during negative feedback in order to activate those no-go units and learn from negative feedback. And so if your overall level of dopamine is high enough, it's going to inhibit those no-go units because D2 receptors are really sensitive even to low levels of tonic dopamine. So if you increase tonic dopamine altogether, and even if the dopamine neurons stop firing for a short amount of time, there's still dopamine in the synapse that's going to be continually stimulating those receptors, and this is not going to have much of an effect.
It's not just a difference from the baseline level.
No, so, okay. It's more of a biophysical mechanism. So back to this task that I tried to motivate from the beginning. So again, here are the 80-20, 70-30, and 60-40, and you get feedback. So the idea is that these positive and negative feedback correspond to increases and decreases in dopamine. And even though these studies were done in monkeys, there's some indirect evidence that the same kind of thing is happening in humans. So the prediction for this task from the model is that Parkinson's patients, when they're on medication, should learn to do this task. So, well, first of all, everybody should learn to choose A over B. That's the easiest pair of the bunch. But that there might be actually different strategies being learned sort of implicitly. So Parkinson's patients, when they're on their medication, they have increases in dopamine during reward, so they should learn to choose A. They should learn go to A. Whereas the patients that are off medication should actually learn to avoid B. They're learning no go to B because they have sufficiently low dopamine levels to learn no go to B, but not high enough dopamine levels to learn go to A. So the question is, how do we test that? Because if you just look at AB performance, everybody's choosing A and avoiding B, so you can't really distinguish. But if you then test them with all novel combinations, so you present A with all the more neutral stimuli, C, D, E, and F, and then you present B with all those same stimuli, you can infer that to the extent that somebody chooses A in all these novel pairs, they've learned that A is good. They've learned go to A. Whereas if they avoid B, in these new pairs, they've learned that B is bad. So does that make sense? Because that logic is pretty critical for the rest of the talk. Okay. So this is not data. This is actually from the model. It's simulated go and no-go representations in the striatum and on the y-axis, and looking at different conditions. In the intact model, you can see it learned just as much about go to A as it learned no-go to B. So it learned that both A was good and no-go was bad. B was bad. Whereas the model with simulated Parkinson's disease learned that B was bad, so it learned no-go to B, but it did not learn go to A. The model was simulated dopamine medication, which elevated dopamine levels but blocked the effects of dopamine dips partially, learned go to A and not no go to B.
What is the y-axis here? Are you subtracting the two
I'm subtracting, so the y-axis is go activity, or it's actually activation-based receptive fields in the striatum. So it's how much go neurons get activated in the striatum to A here, and here is how much no-go neurons get activated to B. So now these are the data in Parkinson's patients on and off medication and in healthy senior controls. So you can see the seniors learn just as much as about choosing A as about avoiding B, whereas Parkinson's patients, when they're off medication, they learn to avoid B but not to choose A as well. As when, but conversely, the patients, when they're on medication, they learn to choose A and they're worse at avoiding B, sort of nicely replicating the overall predictions of the model qualitatively. And then we went on to show that it's not just, I'll come to your question in a second, it's not just an extreme case of Parkinson's disease where there's really low levels of dopamine or medications which are really flooding the system. You can also take healthy undergraduate students and give them a placebo, and they learn just as much about choosing A and avoiding B. But then you could also give them two different dopamine drugs that elevate and or decrease phasic dopamine levels, and they show the same crossover interaction. And this is in a within subject design, so they've come back three different sessions. In some cases, they're learning more from positive feedback. In some cases, they're learning more from negative feedback.
Question? Michael, is this a learning effect or an expression effect? So are you basically letting a weak tendency manifest itself easier if you are on medication? Basically, what you weakly want to do, you know, you do faster. Or is it actually at the stage of learning that something is a go versus no go? Does it make sense, the question?
Yes, it makes a lot of sense. And I think, well, so in the model, it's primarily a learning effect. But I think that same learning effect would get enhanced during expression. So if you learned a little bit about go to A, and then later on you increased dopamine during the expression of that learning, you would enhance that prior learning.
So are you separated in these data, expression versus learning effect?
Okay. That's something we're trying to do in later experiments by training patients first off medication, giving them a dose of their medication, and then later testing them. Yeah. It's a little bit hard to do, but. So far I've addressed points number one and two in this overall framework, which is action selection, so how this model can choose between different actions. Reinforcement learning, which is which choices are most and least likely to lead to reward, so that's probabilistic reward and negative feedback learning. And now I'm going to turn to this dynamic modulation of decision thresholds. And what time should I stop? Just so that I have sense.
Just don't talk beyond 4:30.
Okay. All right, so I have time.
As long as people are asking questions, we're taking up all the question time too.
Okay. So what I'm going to focus on now is this knowing when to take more time to decide for hard decisions and how the basal ganglia might be involved in this aspect of decision making. And so far I've talked about the effects of dopamine medications on learning in Parkinson's disease. But it turns out that another very common treatment for Parkinson's disease is deep brain stimulation. And you'll see why I'm going to talk about this in a second. But in this procedure, they take what's essentially just like a pacemaker. But instead of implanting it into the heart, there's an electrode that goes up into the brain and is implanted into the subthalamic nucleus, which is another part of the basal ganglia, which I haven't talked so much about yet so far. But I'm going to talk about it now. And the reason I'm going to talk about it is because this procedure, when you turn these stimulators on, they're stimulating it at 150 hertz and like around 4 volts, which is both really high for the brain. The patients dramatically improve in their motor symptoms, just like right away. Their tremor goes away. Their rigidity gets better. So that works pretty well for their motor symptoms, but there's increasingly often documentation that this surgery is not that great for the overall quality of life overall. And one of the reasons for that is it actually causes impairments in decision-making and other cognitive deficits. And so what we want to know is from a modeling aspect of what does the subthalamic nucleus do and why would stimulating it actually cause impaired decision-making. So we're going to take this circuit-level model of the basal ganglia and isolate the subthalamic nucleus, which is this part of the model here, and simulate what happens when you stimulate it, and also develop at the same time an overall computational role for how this area is contributing to the decisions. So I'll just very briefly show that in Parkinson's disease, in both humans and animals, if you deplete the striatum from dopamine in a Parkinsonian state, and then you record activity from the subthalamic nucleus, you see these oscillations in firing that correspond to the same frequency as Parkinson's tremor. So these oscillations are thought to be the source of the tremor in Parkinson's disease. And all I'm showing here is that when you do the same thing in the model, you get rid of dopamine in the striatum, it develops these oscillations that are slow oscillations in the subthalamic nucleus and also in other basal ganglia structures. And they've also been recorded to occur there. And the only reason I'm showing this is, well, twofold. One, to say that even though I'm interested in the role of this system in decision-making, the model itself, which looks fairly complex, is also constrained by a fair amount of neural data, and this is just one example of that. But the other reason, the main reason, is to say that actually if you lesion the subthalamic nucleus, you take this area out altogether in animals, these oscillations and Parkinsonian symptoms get better. So the question is, what's the purpose of having this whole brain area if you take it out and Parkinson's symptoms go away? So that's what it says here. The oscillations are eliminated with real lesions of the subthalamic nucleus. And also, what I didn't say is if you lesion this area in the model, the oscillations also go away. So the question is, what good is the subthalamic nucleus? What's its role in the overall decision-making system? So some hints come, again, from some rat literature. So if you actually lesion the subthalamic nucleus in rats that don't have Parkinson's disease, it causes them to make premature responding in choice paradigms. So they respond too quickly. So the idea from the model that I'm about to describe is that you might need a dynamic global no-go signal. So it's a signal for suppressing all responses to allow the basal ganglia to withhold responding until all possible options are considered. So when you're choosing between different actions, you might want to have some mechanism to actually allow you to withhold responding for a while. No. Their accuracy goes down. So they're in that task. But I'll talk about it in human terms in a little bit. So just to back to this circuitry for a minute, the role of the STN in this circuit is thought to be dynamic, essentially global no-go. So what do I mean by that? So the projections from the STN to the output of the basal ganglia are diffuse, which means that these neurons project to a wide range of neurons here. So what that means is that the signal is relatively global in contrast to these no-go projections, which are relatively focused. And the reason why that's interesting is that these neurons might actually be encoding no-go for particular responses in the context of particular stimuli, because they have focused projections. They can independently modulate different responses, whereas this is more of a global signal. So we call it a global signal for suppressing all responses. There's different cases where this area would actually get activated. So it gets inputs from the frontal cortex that would be a dynamic signal. And that input is called the hyperdirect pathway. So this is the direct pathway, this is the indirect pathway, and this is the hyperdirect pathway. Those are the terminologies for basal ganglia. So one aspect of when you would see this area coming into play is when you have a transient increase in frontal cortical activity, specifically frontal cortical areas that project to the STN. And some of the areas that have been shown to project to the STN are the pre-SMA / anterior cingulate, which are the same areas that get activated, particularly when you have response conflict. So when you're choosing between two different responses and you have a lot of conflict, you have this sudden increase in activity in the anterior cingulate. According to this model, this would transiently activate the STN, which would provide a global no-go signal, a transient global no-go signal. So what that would do, effectively, is when you have response conflict, when you're making a difficult decision, that would lead to this signal that we refer to as like a hold your horses signal. It says, wait, the decision I'm making right now is hard, so I better slow down. I better raise the threshold for making a decision. So that would actually allow your system more time to integrate over the noise in the system and to accumulate the evidence. And if you're familiar with mathematical models of decision making, it's equivalent to increasing the decision boundary in a drift diffusion model. And if you're not, you can just ignore that sentence. I'll show a quick simulation of that as well. So here we're back to two possible responses. They're both getting activated. There's conflict. There's go signals for both responses here. This area is severely activated, the STN. That's this global no-go signal that eventually subsides and lets the one that's the best response to actually get selected. Here it is again. You're going to see go for both responses get activated, but we don't actually allow one of them to get executed right away. because this system is preventing it from executing one of them. Eventually, the go for response one is stronger than the other one, and so that one wins and gets facilitated. Okay, so how does that correspond to the probabilistic task that I was talking about before? So it's the same task, again, probabilistic selection. But now, instead of dividing up the test pairs according to positive and negative feedback, I'm going to divide them up according to conflict. So a low conflict would be choosing between 80 versus 30% reward values. Those are pretty easy to discriminate against. Whereas high conflict would be like 80 versus 70%. These are two options that both have fairly good reward value. And you might want to actually slow down in that case to take more time. And so the prediction is that you need the STN to prevent impulsive responding in this case when you have two pretty good reward values in order to choose actually the best one. So this is showing in just healthy controls, either healthy senior controls, and here we're showing reaction times for correct trials in this win-win conflict situation, 80 versus 70. So you can see that in the low conflict case, they have reaction time around here, and they slow down by around 100 milliseconds or so in correct trials for high conflict. So the normal thing to do is to actually slow down to take more time to make the harder decision. It's kind of intuitive. But the prediction is that the subthalamic nucleus is involved in allowing you to actually do this slowdown effect. So,
can I ask?
Yeah.
So I have to admit I didn't actually get around to reading this paper, but so would you make different, so stop me if you're going to answer this, but would you make different predictions in the case of high conflict for where both of them are essentially go things versus high conflict where both of them are essentially no-go things, like 20%
yes.
versus 30%?
Right. Yeah, so we
so
test...
I assume there'd be some...
We do test that as well. I think the short answer is that in the 80-70 both win-win, you sort of have two factors. You have one where there's conflict, and you also have another one where you have this sort of increase in dopamine because both of them are good. An increase in dopamine causes you to be more impulsive, makes you want to respond even faster. So the claim is that in that situation, you would actually, if you don't have this mechanism for slowing down, you actually might even respond faster than the low conflict condition. Whereas in this lose-lose 20%, 30% conflict, you only have conflict going on. You don't really have this mechanism for causing impulsive, fast responding. And so we are able to distinguish between those in this task. So this is just back at the model to show that the model predicts what I'm saying it predicts. This is in blue, the subthalamic nucleus activity during a low conflict decision. You can see it during, this is cross time. It rises in activity, then it goes down, and then the model makes a choice. You just have to believe me, this brown essentially means the model is making a choice. And here is in a high conflict situation, you can see the same thing happens but to a higher degree. So the subthalamic nucleus has a stronger initial global no-go signal as a result of its increased conflict activity, and that leads to a slower responding, so a slower reaction time. And I'm going to skip that, I think. But the prediction is, what we did is we took patients on and off deep brain stimulation of the subthalamic nucleus, and the prediction is that deep brain stimulation actually disrupts normal subthalamic nucleus processing. So there's different theories on how it does that, and we simulated different aspects of it. But essentially what we're, the main prediction from the model is that deep brain stimulation should impair the ability to slow down due to high conflict, because the subthalamic nucleus is no longer integrating its normal cortical inputs, but instead you're stimulating it at this really high frequency, which prevents it from responding to its other natural inputs. So this is what we found. Actually, this is the model. Again, I'm showing the model prediction. This is an intact model, and this is reaction time of the model, the number of cycles it takes to actually facilitate a particular action in the low and high conflict condition. So it replicates the basic effect that it slows down under high conflict. This is the model with simulated Parkinson's disease. It also has this conflict effect. It looks like it's a little amplified there. Simulated medication, it also shows a slowdown effect. But when it has simulated deep brain stimulation, when you actually simulate the effects of deep brain stimulation in the model, it shows this opposite pattern of results where it actually speeds up for high conflict. And this is for the high conflict win-win case, when both of them are good. When both of them are bad, it just doesn't really do much there. Yeah.
How long does the deep brain stimulation, how long after deep brain stimulation are you relieved from symptoms? And is the time course that the symptoms come back the same as the time course of this affected decision making?
So when you turn on the deep brain stimulation, the effects are pretty immediate.
But how long after the stimulation's over are they relieved?
Right. So it's not very well clear. The time course of turning it off is slower than the time course of turning it on. But their tremor does start to come back, you know, just anecdotally when I work with the patients, sometimes around 10 minutes, 15 minutes. In the studies that we've done, we turn them off for 30 minutes before they do the experiment, and that's just based on what other people have done. Their tremor definitely comes back at that time. But this is just the model so far. This is the actual pattern of results in this win-win conflict situation, 80 versus 70 versus low conflict. So this is seniors again. This is the same data that I showed you before, low and high conflict, slow down. These are Parkinson's patients off medication, low and high conflict, slow down. Same patients on medication, slow down. So the medication doesn't have an effect at least on the relative difference in reaction time and slowing. And these are patients when they're off their deep brain stimulators, they slow down. And this is when they're on their deep brain stimulators, and you can see there's just massive reversal of the effect. They actually speed up for this high conflict, sort of impulsive responding situation. And subsequent analysis showed that the more that they did that, the more they were likely to make errors in those trials.
So are these correct-only trials?
This is correct-only trials, but actually if you look at error-only trials, that this effect is much bigger. So essentially when they're making errors, they're responding that much faster, so it's premature responding.
In the case where they're on the deep brain.
You mean from here to here?
Yeah.
From off to
in
on.
In both the model and in this case, the low conflict cases are taking longer.
Yeah, this is not a significant effect. In the model, let's see. We don't have. Oh yeah, it does seem to go up there. Oh right, I know why it does in the model. So this is the case where we're actually simulating. We simulated different aspects of deep brain stimulation. There are different theories on how it works. One theory is that it works like a lesion, where you're stimulating it so hard that you're preventing the neurons there from actually getting active at all. If you simulate that, then you get the same pattern, but the whole thing goes down. So you don't see this increase in conflict. But if you see in this particular case that I'm showing here, we're simulating sort of a high frequency regular firing in the STN, which essentially amplifies overall the global no-go signal regardless of what kind of conflict situation there is. So that makes the overall reaction time slower. But that's sort of a parametric issue, and I don't think it's really that, I don't think it's that critical. I think you could simulate the same thing with a different parameter and you can get the thing to go down or up.
So if I understand what you're saying, it's not really that it's no longer sensitive to high conflict, it's that everything's conflict.
In this particular situation, well, everything is conflict, but actually when it gets conflict, it responds faster, right?
Yeah.
So it seems like everything is getting a little bit more conflict, but then when you have two things that are good, you still have that increase in dopamine, so there's the conflicting factor to the conflict, if that was convoluted enough. Others? Yeah.
So this deep brain stimulation treatment, is that
Yeah, it's more investigational at this point. I'm not that familiar with how well that works at this point. For Parkinson's disease, it's actually very standard now. There's like two surgeries a week in Tucson where we do it, and it basically works at least for the motor symptoms. For Tourette's syndrome, I think it's still exploratory, but I'm not exactly sure. And also Tourette's syndrome is also a basal ganglia disorder that leads to impulsive responding or disinhibition of actions. So,
you know, why isn't this just a general increase of noise which just loses differentiation? I mean, is the reversal significant? You think the difference is significant now, the low conflict becomes, or is the interaction significant?
Both are significant. So this is the model. If you want to look at the actual data.
So the star says that this simple effect becomes significant?
Yeah, both the interaction and the simple effect is significant.
Right.
Yeah. So it's not just noise. There are actually
noise. Why do you predicting now that suddenly in high conflict they should respond faster? I just don't, Sorry, can you say why they should respond?
It's a high conflict, win-win situation.
Right, so I'm, right. So I have a lot of dopamine firing, which makes me want to go, right, to anything, right?
You have, well, you have both a lot of dopamine and you have, you've learned go signals to both possible responses, so they both get executed. They both get amplified in the striatum, and if one of them happens to get executed.
So you need Gary's condition where you have, you know,
lose-lose.
Lose-lose, right,
right.
To see if this is just general confusion or this is just really.
Well, so yeah, we do have the lose-lose situation. I don't know if I have the slide on this talk, but what happens there is everybody else again slows down and the patients just show no differentiation. So they don't speed up, but they don't slow down. So it is, it's still consistent with the overall account. Yeah?
So on a high conflict situation, do you look across time, across trials, and how much they're looking at a particular point? Because high conflict responses will change with motivational state. So
okay.
If you're winning a lot, you may just go quickly because it's a win-win situation. If you're losing a lot, you want to win the most, and so you'll actually take a bit more time. So can you look at behavioral contrast and learning and see if it's in the high conflict situation?
We can look at something that's like that. For this particular effect, this is during the test phase where there's no feedback.
Right.
So they've already learned all the reward associations and you're just giving them a bunch of low and high conflict pairs. So
I mean they're winning and losing during the test situation.
No, there's no feedback.
Oh, there's no feedback.
Right. They're just going based on their gut.
It's just a pure preference.
Right.
Okay. So why do they care? I mean, do you...
What? Because they want to...
Are they getting reward? Do they find out at the end that they made so much money or?
Nope. It's just pure motivation to select the best stimulus that they learned from. They definitely like getting positive feedback, but more so they hate getting negative feedback during the learning phase. Patients and everybody hates getting negative feedback, even though they're getting far less negative feedback than they are getting positive feedback. And so they learned these reward associations to these different stimuli and they're trying to generalized based on them in the test space. Okay.
Would you predict any differences if they were getting feedback during these tests? I don't know if that's an interesting question or not.
Well, the reason there might be some differences in sort of trial to trial adaptation effects, which is what I'm going to talk about next. But we give no feedback because we want to have some measure of what they learned during the training phase, sort of trying to freeze their weights, so to speak. We don't want to have them have any more learning. So this is just showing that same data again, model and data. So finally, I'll talk about one other aspect of this, and this is Gary just asked a good question to lead up to that, is how, what do I mean by working memory maintenance of recent action outcome values in this particular task and in the striatal cortical circuit? I'll motivate this a little bit. So I'm going to talk now about reinforcement learning and decision making according to basal ganglia function and not the frontal part of the cortex that I've been talking about so far, but more prefrontal cortical areas and orbitofrontal cortex. And there's two different literatures out there that are, for the most part, haven't been connected so much, where the striatum and dopamine has been studied in the context of Parkinson's disease and other reinforcement learning situations, and the orbitofrontal cortex is studied in the context of other kinds of reward and decision making tasks. And so we know that damage to the part of the frontal cortex, that some damage to orbitofrontal cortex, prefrontal areas involved in reward and decision making, leads to decision making deficits in patient populations. So the question is, computationally, what are the differences between these two different systems? How do they both contribute? Are they just redundant, or are they doing different things? So, for instance, damage to orbitofrontal cortex or ventral medial prefrontal cortex, I'm not really distinguishing between these areas for this purpose, leads to deficits in decision making, so patients will choose frequent small rewards even when incurring infrequent losses. So that's in the context of often cited the Iowa gambling task. Reversal learning, so learning to change reward values of stimulus action or stimulus action outcomes very quickly on a trial-to-trial basis. And reward devaluation is another case where reward changes all of a sudden, the reward aspects change. In all of these cases, the patients with damage to these frontal reward areas have impairments. They're slower to learn the new reward contingencies. And so one of the general intuitions is that the basal ganglia component of the model that I've described so far can slowly integrate dopamine signals over time to compute the probability of an action leading to a reward or lack thereof, whereas the orbitor frontal cortex can actively represent recent reinforcement values in working memory. And that includes not only the probability, but the magnitude of reward values. So just to motivate that a little bit and show how the orbitor frontal cortex can potentially support more adaptive and flexible behavior, first of all, it receives reinforcement magnitude information from the basolateral amygdala. So the amygdala has also been shown to compute magnitude of reinforcement values, and it sends that information to the frontal reward areas for subsequent processing. There's some evidence that the orbitor frontal cortex can maintain recent reinforcement values in like a working memory state in much the same way as dorsolateral prefrontal cortex has been thought to encode working memory via persistent firing of neurons over delayed periods. And in prefrontal cortex, the role of dopamine is not necessarily the same as the role of dopamine in the striatum. So computational models of this show that it increases the signal-to-noise ratio and effectively enhances the maintenance properties of prefrontal neurons in working memory. And finally, there seems to be top-down effects on decision-making from these frontal reward areas onto the motor cortical areas and also indirectly through the basal ganglia. So orbital frontal cortex can learn its own representations of reward magnitudes, maintain them in working memory, and have a top-down biasing effect to interact with what I call this more sort of primitive basal ganglia system. So in trying to model that, I'm not going to go into any detail at all about this model, except to show that what's in brown here is just the standard basal ganglia model that I already described. And then on top here are some areas trying to model the reinforcement magnitude and working memory values that interact with the rest of the system. And sort of the high-level description of this is that the orbitor frontal cortex can actively maintain recent stimulus reinforcement values in a working memory-like state and bias motor output for flexible behavior. And this is just to show, if you can concentrate, I guess we'll start on the left. This is in a sort of simulated gambling task where the model has to learn to choose between two different options that are different, that differ in their probability of reward, so similar to the ones that I've described so far. And I'm looking at the full model with the orbitor frontal cortex and just the plain basal ganglia model with an orbitor frontal lesion, so to speak. And you can see that both models eventually learn in this pure probabilistic condition. The model with orbitor frontal cortex learns faster, but the basal ganglia model eventually catches up, and in this case actually does better, but that's, I think, an artifact. And then in this case over here is when the model actually has to learn about both magnitudes and frequencies, and particularly the magnitudes of reward values are in opposition to frequency. So what that means is when you choose a particular stimulus, most of the time it might be non-rewarding, but on a small percentage of trials you might get a big reward. Or most of the time it's rewarding, but a small percentage of trials you get a big loss. So you have to integrate the expected value of the decision and incorporate both magnitude and frequency. And in this case, you can see the orbitor frontal model does really well, whereas the model with the pure basal ganglia model actually starts choosing incorrectly. It's locked onto the frequency of decisions.
So I was hoping you were going to show this graph. In the gambling, in the just frequency condition, where the rewards are the same in either case, it looks like the full model actually gets worse over time. So can you explain why that is?
Well, so
it looks like it's getting actually
it learns really quickly here.
Yes, it learns really quickly.
And then it starts being kind of stupid.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I keep saying this every time I present this, but I haven't gone back to see why that happens, and I think it's not a real function of how I think this area is contributing to decision making, and I think it's kind of just the model not behaving properly, basically. The orbitor frontal cortex gets too noisy or something happens where it starts going down, and part of it has to do with probability matching. I think that when you have a really good working memory representation of recent values, then you're more likely to match based on whatever happened last rather than extracting the pure probability. So the basal ganglia doesn't have that. It just integrates frequency and it selects the best one. But
so I don't think it's trial to trial effects.
I think that's part of the reason. I don't think it should have gone as bad as it did, and it, I do need to revisit that.
But the reviewers let it through.
They did, yeah.
I, you know, I'm just a clarification question. Like,
I could have just cut off the graph here, and then you would have done that.
Yeah, really good.
Yeah.
I maybe I missed something about this assumption about why orbitofrontal cortex should maintain, be more responsible for the magnitude information, but not, and why should this involve some sort of active maintenance? Because, I mean, it's, you, just from the kind of conditioning, you know, perspective, I mean, a strong reinforcement would just gonna be, you don't need active maintenance to basically be sensitive to the reinforcement magnitude. Right. I mean, so why does sensitivity to the reinforced magnitude requires active maintenance?
I didn't say that, so that you didn't miss it. It's not the maintenance itself that requires that supports magnitude information. It's more just having a graded population, a distributed population of units that allows you to encode differences in magnitude, a sort of coarse-coded representations of magnitude value. And the dopamine system itself is really just this signal that does encode magnitude to some extent, according to some of the studies, but I don't think it's nearly graded enough to incorporate all the expected values of decisions.
Well, let me put it more crudely. I mean, like in studies on amygdala, it's often, you know, one hit, big hit, that gets responsible for learning. And I don't think people would say that amygdala is kind of active maintenance or something.
No. So the active maintenance part of it is really just allowing you to remember what happened more recently. So if you're talking about the current representation of a magnitude of a reward or punishment, you don't need active maintenance at all. So I'm just saying that what the active maintenance properties of the orbitofrontal cortex does in this model is allows you to remember the most recent magnitude of information that happened in an active state over trial. So I think that maybe it'll be more clear when I get to the very next slide. Okay.
You understand the part about why you need both things to learn this task, right?
I do, yeah, of course, right. I mean,
so one of the stories is that in the basal ganglia, there, as Michael was saying, there's just there's differences in the amount of dopamine you get with respect to the reward, but they're sublinear with respect to the actual size of the reward, and the system itself is nonlinear, so it doesn't necessarily give you a good enough representation to learn magnitude at the basal ganglia level.
Oh, I don't have this here. Sorry, I thought I actually have a slide that tries to go through these different arguments, but it's not in this talk, so I'm going to have to just go back.
but there's evidence that the magnitude of the response in medial and lateral orbital frontal cortex is proportional to the size of the reward.
Right. Okay, so it has nothing to do with active maintenance. It has to do with just coding for magnitude versus coding for frequency.
Right.
Okay, that's why I got confused, because you start talking about working memory and active
intent. So the amygdala by itself, I think, could encode graded magnitudes of reward value, and it does in the model too.
Right.
And the orbitofrontal cortex sort of represents that in a stimulus-specific way, and then maintains that over trials in a working memory-like state.
Oh, so it's an integrator of frequency and magnitude information.
Yes.
Okay, got it.
Okay, I'm unclear now. I thought I was, but now I'm confused. But what do you mean by graded magnitude?
So what I mean by graded magnitude is you could win. So let's say you're in a gambling task and you could win $1, $2.50, or $1,000. And if you want to actually be able to compute the expected value or the magnitude, all those different magnitudes in a fairly precise way, then I'm saying that a system that has a population of units that to be able to code those different values in a graded way is
so
better than having just a global dopamine signal.
You're not saying that the proportion of firing is relative to the magnitude by some set algorithm.
No.
You're just saying that they're differentially coded such that they can be discriminated.
And I mean, in the particular model, the way it's implemented is that higher magnitudes have higher number of units and higher firing rate overall than lower magnitudes. But that doesn't have to be the way that it actually is.
And you're saying that happens in the amygdala?
No, well, in the orbitofrontal cortex.
Okay.
Yeah.
So So in order to get the value, Andrea, you need both the frequency of the reward and the size of the reward, and that gives you the expected value.
Yeah, I know what an expected value is.
Okay.
But I was just talking about whether the units code.
Yeah, so the story is this is OFC and
wait, that's my data.
What? What?
It's her data.
Sorry.
Okay. So we're beginning to test this sort of frequency versus magnitude aspect of orbital frontal cortex and striatum on decision making using imaging and hopefully in frontal lesioned patients soon. But so far we're beginning to test different aspects of this model using genetic studies. So what we did is we just looked at regular undergrads again, and instead we looked at three different genes all coding for different aspects of dopamine function, but dopamine in the striatum versus frontal cortex. So the three genes that I'm going to refer to have these acronyms again: DARP32, DRD2, and COMT. And I'll show you what those mean in a second. So the first one, DARP32, is a protein that's concentrated very much in the striatum and not so much in frontal cortex. It's activated by D1 receptor stimulation. So remember, D1 receptors are involved in goal learning in the model. And its main role is to mediate the dopamine effects on plasticity. So it's in the intracellular signaling cascade. When I say that dopamine increases plasticity or increases learning, this is one of the proteins involved in that complex pathway that's involved in actually increasing plasticity. And the particular gene that I've looked at has been shown to have a functional effect. This is just showing between two different groups of subjects, whether they have one form of this gene or another form of the gene, they have differential activation of the striatum and no reported effects on any other brain area. So we took this gene, we ran subjects on the same probabilistic task. I think if I do that. And then we predicted that that this gene would modulate probabilistic goal learning because it's involved in the striatum. It's modulating D1 receptor activation in the striatum. And that is indeed what we found. So these are in 69 undergraduate students, and we divided them up into two different sets of genotypes. And you can see the people who have more efficient DARP32 processing. They have two A copies of the A allele in there in this genotype, learn better from choosing A than avoiding B, whereas people who have the other copy of the gene seem to have the opposite pattern, non-significantly, but the interaction is significant. They learn relatively better from Go in this group than in that group. So even though overall healthy people learn just like this, straight, just as much about choosing A and avoiding B, you can actually differentiate them based on individual differences, which we've done with some electrophysiological studies, but in this case, in a genetic study. But then there's another gene that I think makes even more specific prediction, because it's a gene that codes for the D2 receptor in the striatum. And the model predicts that the D2 receptor in the striatum is involved in slowly integrating basal ganglia no-go signals. So this gene should predict the avoidance of the most sort of aversive stimulus on average. And aversive, I just mean lack of reward. So the model prediction is that this particular gene, which has been shown to modulate D2 receptor function in the striatum, should predict avoid B test performance, but not choose A. And again, there's an effect. In this case, it was particularly big effect and selective. So people who have this TT form of the DRD2 gene, those are the people who have been shown to have greater numbers of D2 striatal D2 receptors, or at least greater availability of those receptors. And they perform much better at avoiding B than people who have less striatal D2 receptors, with no effect on choosing A in this paradigm. So now we have two genes, one that seems to predict relatively better go learning, another gene that seems to predict relatively better no-go learning. And this is just to show that if you look at the gene dose effect, so if you look at people with the TT gene with one copy of the T and then CC, and this is the study that looked at striatal D2 binding, this is not my study, and they showed a relatively linear effect, so more T alleles lead to more D2 receptors in the striatum. Also in our study, more T alleles lead to better avoid B accuracy. This is just avoid B accuracy in a sort of linear fashion. So it's sort of a parametric effect predicting no-go learning in our task. Okay, so how does that relate to this model of orbital frontal cortex, or at least prefrontal cortex involvement in decision-making and learning? So finally, we're going to look at one last gene, the COMT gene, which is really well studied. It predicts the amount of dopamine that people have in their frontal cortex. with relatively little effects in the striatum. So now we're looking at dopamine function, but in the prefrontal cortex and not striatum. It has been shown that in contrast to the basal ganglia and in contrast to these phasic effects, when you experience negative outcomes, you see actually increases in dopamine over long periods of time in prefrontal cortex during aversive events. These are in animal studies. And models of prefrontal cortex dopamine suggest, as I mentioned briefly before, that dopamine essentially enhances the robust maintenance properties of prefrontal neurons. And so according to this model of orbital frontal cortex, increases of dopamine tonically during negative events in prefrontal cortex should support the maintenance of recent reinforcement values to guide subsequent behavior. So it's not the same as this probabilistic learning. Instead, it corresponds in this task that I'm talking about to trial-to-trial adjustments in the training phase. And so I'll be more concrete about that here. So this is for picture the task. People are choosing between E and F, let's say. This is just an example. Let's say they choose E. This is during the learning phase of the task. And let's say they get negative feedback. Then the next trial, they have A, B, and they choose A. Maybe they get positive feedback. C, D, they get negative feedback. The question is, how likely are they in this trial to remember that the last time they chose E, they got negative feedback? To hold that into working memory in the face of these intervening sort of distracting trials, at least distracting with relevance to the EF trial, so how likely are they to remember this negative feedback experience and actually switch their behavior to choose F in this trial? And similarly, you can do the same thing with CD. How likely are they to remember that D was bad in order to change to C in this trial? So that's a trial-to-trial sort of working memory effect. It's different from the probabilistic slow integration effect. And so when you look at this prefrontal dopamine gene, you could see that there is an effect. People who have the greatest levels of prefrontal dopamine, according to the gene, were much better at this sort of loose shift trial-to-trial behavior. No effect on the win-stay version of it. And this gene, I don't have the graph here, also did not affect the probabilistic outcomes in the task in one way or the other.
I'm sorry, so this gene codes for dopamine
in prefrontal cortex
receptors, or
no? Okay, so it codes for an enzyme called COMT, catecholamine ethyl transferase, which is what degrades dopamine in prefrontal, or it degrades dopamine, and in prefrontal cortex, it's the only way effectively of degrading dopamine from the synapse, and so it has a massive effect on how much dopamine people have extracellularly in prefrontal cortex. So if they have this form of the gene, they have more overall prefrontal dopamine. If they have this form of the gene, they have less dopamine. And so other studies have shown that people with this form of the gene do better overall at prefrontal tasks, working memory, cognitive control, other things.
But so you have these stories that you don't want to tell anymore about medial versus lateral, and
right.
One remembers punishment, one remembers reward, so this would affect your memory. You're talking about memory of punishment here, is that right?
Yes, I'm talking about memory of punishment, and so the main reason I think that this might have an effect on punishment more than on win-stay performance, I think there's multiple reasons, but one of them might be the fact that negative events seem to elevate dopamine tonically, and so dopamine might be more important in prefrontal cortex for maintaining working memory values for negative outcomes, which is sort of counterintuitive because it's the opposite of dopamine in the striatum. But there's a lot of evidence that dopamine in striatum and prefrontal cortex actually interact negatively. So if you have greater frontal dopamine, you have less striatal dopamine, and vice versa. So this doesn't say anything about medial versus lateral.
Right, but you are saying something about it's just the memory of the negative versus the...
Right, well,
So you have lose shift, win stay. What about win shift and lose stay? Or something. I mean, so when, you could have discovered by chance you picked something that normally you would lose on, but you won, say, I don't know, it's hard to make up this example because it's kind of counter.
All right.
So.
And are these basically the accurate, are these only the correct loose shifts and win stays? Well, I guess the win stay has to be accurate, right?
Right. I guess that's why I have trouble coming up with
accurate, you mean?
Well, you know, if you want, you right. Right, because it doesn't, doesn't make sense.
Yeah, actually, so what I didn't say, because I'm going through some of this quickly, is that, and I think if I recall correctly, that this graph was made, it's true overall, but it's more true if you look in just the very early part of the training trials, uh-huh. when people don't know the probabilities of the stimuli. Because eventually, if you're choosing, let's say, A, and you get negative feedback, you know that sometimes A is going to be negative.
Oh, right. Because
so that's not a, it's not a good thing to shift after right. getting negative feedback to A.
Right, right.
So it turns out the people with this gene do this shifting a lot early on, and they ramp it down quickly because they realize what is the most probabilistically optimal thing to do.
Right, so this is basically a learning effect, you know, you could say that, I mean, so it's better, this is basically reflects more adjustment, adaptive. It's just, you know, it's just basically if you do show greater percentage of loose shift, you basically a faster learner in that particular case.
Faster learning, the question is whether you're really learning or are you just remembering in working memory what happened last time and changing your behavior. And that's not necessarily the same as learning in sort of a synaptic sense, in a sense that's allowing you to integrate probabilities. So I think that there's actually, the striatal system is what I think is the learning system for integrating, you know, what's the most probabilistic outcome of decisions. And this is more of like a memory system of what happened mm-hmm. the very last time. But you could think of it as learning in some sense.
Right.
There are no control subjects because everybody has a form of gene.
A form of the gene. So it's just which form.
It's just which form you have. But you can say there's a control subjects where you look at the other genes which are not predicted to modulate this form. And it has, so the striatal genes have no effect on this, and this gene has no effect on those other striatal gene effects. So.
Are these older subjects?
No, these are just undergraduate subjects. Yeah. It's pretty hard because the stimuli are hard to verbalize, and it's actually a pretty big working memory load because you have all these different stimuli and they're interfering with each other. But also, like I said, it's not always good to lose shift, right? Because, right. So the actual values, I'm not sure. I mean, you could just do some statistics about what would be the best thing to do, but it would depend on a few things. Dave.
I mean, this is sort of more of a general question, but so a lot of these sort of very nice crossover interactions, maybe you can sort of think of them as people are, whether they're more focused on sort of the positive versus more focused on the negative. And so I wonder if there aren't like mood correlates of many of these things. Like if you ask, you know, if you just ask, somehow it sets mood at these different
right.
Genetic types.
Yeah.
Or with, you know, deep brain stimulation versus not. Or
right. Right.
It's hard to get undergraduates to volunteer for
deep brain. there's a student working on this in depression to try to see if depressed subjects have a negative learning bias. And actually, what he's finding is the opposite, that they are impaired at learning from negative feedback. But so far, it hasn't been done to actually, I know someone who's done this in Amsterdam, who's actually gotten healthy older subjects, seniors, who in their task had slightly negative bias, then allowed them to watch a happy movie and actually increased their positive learning. So there does seem to be some state-dependent effects on it. But that doesn't say one way or the other whether it's
right.
mediated
it's
by dopamine or, right, yeah, right. Okay, so I think I'll just wrap up with that. Skip these math models and go to the summary, which is that dopamine modulates go and no-go reinforcement learning in the basal ganglia separately via D1 and D2 receptors, according to the models, and some support from data. But the subthalamic nucleus is involved in dynamically adjusting the decision threshold, so slowing down when decisions are hard. Prefrontal areas are needed for rapid trial-to-trial adjustments in behavior and for integrating expected value of decisions rather than just pure probability. And that genes that affect striatal and prefrontal dopamine separately modulate these decision processes in ways that are consistent. And finally, that models are useful tools for guiding experiments that can lead to, what do I say, theoretical insights, but that every model is oversimplified and every theory is wrong. So with that, I'll say thanks to Scott Sherman, is my main collaborator in Arizona with Parkinson's patients. He's a neurologist and very enthusiastic collaborator. It's been great. Ahmed Mustafa has contributed his postdoc in my lab doing some of the math modeling of the genetic stuff that I didn't get a chance to talk about. And all the other people both in Colorado and Arizona have contributed a lot to all of this research. And finally, I need to thank all Parkinson's patients for participating in voluntarily going off their medications and deep brain stimulation, which is really a sacrifice for science. And that's, I think that's it.